that's helping to save OIC, the Opportunities Industrial Center, which has become a worldwide organization through in Africa and so forth. And,
save it in terms of?
It was going under financially and was in very bad shape. Reverend Sullivan came to see me, and I always remember it was the first time I'd ever met him. He's a huge bear of a man. And he came to see me, and he said, we're going under, and we need somebody to help us. And I said, well, Reverend, I said, define the problem for me. And he told me, we owe $1 million, and can't raise it, and we need money. And I said, well, I've always admired what you're doing. I like the work that you're doing. I think it's important work. And I'll raise $1 million for you. And we went out and raised $1 million for him. And I said, but you got to agree. I said, Reverend, well, you're not running the church. I mean, if you want to run this program, you got to run it in a business-like way. And you commit to that, and I'll go out and raise $1 million. And a young man from my organization went in there as chairman of the OIC, Jim Tolman, and tried to help get them straightened out. And we were successful in raising $1 million. ARCO stepped forward for $250,000. We just had a breakfast. Jim Tolman came over. They had problems again. He raised money. The old buildings had fallen apart. And so we had a breakfast. Reverend Sullivan came, and he said to me, you know, how do we revitalize this? And I said, well, let's bring Reverend Sullivan and invite a bunch of people to come. And he'll draw them and then tell them what you want and what to do. And it was interesting. Halfway through the meeting, it was like a revival. He got up there and he spoke. And he still has that magnetic appeal. John Street came in, and apparently John Street went through the OIC program. And Sullivan said something which was very interesting at this breakfast. He said, you know, he said, when we started, he said, we were teaching people how to run lathes, and everybody was very critical because there weren't too many jobs in Philadelphia for machinists and that kind of thing. He said, but they missed the whole message. He said, what we do is change attitudes. And we take people who believe that they can accomplish nothing in life. He said, and we teach them pride and dependability and trustworthiness. And he said, and the rest comes afterwards. He said, but we change attitudes. He said. And I have a funny story to tell about him. He invited me to a meeting one time in City Hall. And I got over there, and I was the only white person. This room was filled with hundreds of black people, all unemployed. And Sullivan got up to the podium, just a little podium in the front of the room, and he stood up, and he took off his glasses, and he threw them across the room, and he said, I'm angry! And they hollered back, he's angry! And he hollered, I'm angry! Louder, he's angry! And again, and I'm sitting there fidgeting in a chair. Black man next to me, I forget who it was, he hits me in the side. He says, brother, he says, when he hollers he's angry, you holler he's angry, and you'll fit right in. And I did, but while I was sitting there, I have to say, I was thinking about, how the hell am I going to get out of this room? 300 or 400 unemployed people that he's whipping up into a fervor about being angry. And then he went on to say he was angry because he said, when a black man shoots a black man, it's in the press. When a black man does this and so forth, it's in the press. Where are the press today when we're here, black men helping black men, with our good friend over here was organic. So it was interesting, and it was kind of like a revival. And as I was leaving, somebody put their hand on my shoulder. It was a big, strapping young black man. He said to me, he said, "Brother, just want to thank you for pitching in and helping us." And it was a great experience, and I've maintained my friendship with Dr. Sullivan and with the organization for more than 20 years. So I feel good about that, and it is a worldwide movement now. And of course, he's done other great things like the Sullivan Principles and so forth. But basically, fundamentally, I said, look, can't afford to let this fail. This is where it started, and if you fail in Philadelphia, you fail everywhere. And so we were able to infuse that money to keep it going and to bring in some professional management. So, you know, as I look back on my involvement in the community, it's those things that I look back on, and then, you know, other initiatives in education and homeless. We helped Sister Mary Scullion get her start, those kinds of things. And as I said before, to do the things that other people wouldn't do. Bill Green asked me to chair the summer jobs program. You know, they wanted to provide 20,000 jobs for young people, get commitments to do that, keep them off the streets, show them what it's like to work in the business. And I took on that challenge. Everybody would take it. And we were very successful in doing that. Reagan invited me to the White House because of the success of that program. I think first it was Jimmy Carter. And after that, Reagan, I went down to see both of them. I did that program for Bill Green, and I did it for Wilson Good. And it was interesting going down to the White House, and I found Carter considerably more genuine than Reagan. When I was there, and thanked us, he knew why we were there, thanked us for it, and so forth. Had a chance to shake his hand, got a picture taken. I think both of which are outside in the show. But the Summer Jobs program was another thing that they couldn't get anybody to work on that, and that was tough getting people to agree to hire these young people and to help train them. And I think we accomplished something. So those are the things that I look for, to try and find the things that where you could make a difference. I mean, you know, they can get a lot of people to be on the Philadelphia Orchestra board. I mean, I'm on that too, but they can replace me in 5 seconds. But they can't get somebody who's going to accept the challenge of trying to place 20,000 kids in the summertime, or some of these other things. So I always directed my efforts at those things that were difficult to do that other people didn't want to do. And some of the young people who I've been friendly with and so forth, I find doing the same things, and I think that's just great. And some of the people in the company that I worked with over the years, I see them sprinkled around in various organizations, and I feel good about that because that's one of the things that you try to do, is to set a tone and example that encourages people to do various things. The other thing that in Philadelphia that I've been on is the orchestra board. I've been on that for 20 years. Seen a lot of change there, and I've enjoyed that. I enjoy classical music. I absolutely love being president of the Academy of Music because I love the building, as I do the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts building, two of the finest buildings in the city. Academy of Fine Arts is designed by Frank Furness. Magnificent building. And the Academy of Music as well. And just recently completed a $31 million fundraising campaign for for the Academy of Music and kind of and overseeing its restoration, and we just won an award from the Victorian Society of America for the kind of restoration we're doing there, which I think is one of the finest historical renovations that's been carried out in this country. It's absolutely amazing what they had to do. It's a building built, 32-inch wide brick, straight up, no foundations. interesting heating systems and so forth. Furnace tubes in the basement and stacks that just go up through the building, where by convection the heat goes through the building. When we redid it, we left the walls, all those vents open all the way up so that you could see the way the building was heated. So it's a very, very interesting restoration. And as I say, we unfortunately overspent $31 million. But I think we have the ability to raise that, and that says something. There's a whole other thrust. A lot of people say Philadelphians aren't generous, but they are quite generous. But they're only generous where they feel something can be accomplished. Walter Annenberg had given $10 million towards this construction, and Pew had given $7.5 million, and they had not. At the Academy of Music I'm talking about, and they had not raised much else. But when I took over as chairman and went out to raise money, I got a very good response from a lot of people. And the reason for that was they felt, because of my background, my reputation, that I could deliver on the project. The same thing is true with Willard Rouse and the new concert hall. Stalled in the quagmire for years, moving forward now. Why? Because people believe that Willard Rouse can get it done. And he will. And just like he did Liberty Place, which really changed the whole atmosphere downtown. So, you know, I find that there's a lot of money in Philadelphia. There's a lot of new money. Continues to be a lot of old money. And there are many things that have to be done in Philadelphia, and you can access both of the kinds of money for things that need to be done civically. But people aren't going to give money to anyone that they don't believe can get something done. And I always say there are three societies in Philadelphia. There's Philadelphia Society, and you're born to that, and you never become part of that without having been born to that. And they have the assembly ball in December, to which you're invited to as part of the 400 family. Never been to that. Don't expect I ever will be. Then there's a kind of a business society of people who run corporations, are involved in business and so forth, and they all know each other. Socialize together, relate together, participate in things, they make things happen. And then there's an entrepreneurial society, which is another group of very wealthy people that have made a lot of money, and they're kind of a society unto themselves. And there are three different groups, and if you can combine the three together in one endeavor, you can accomplish almost anything. And so, to me, that's one of the things that I've always understood that, I know that, and one of the things that I've always tried to do is to be a bridge between those three, because I can move in any of them. And so I like to think of myself as being able to bridge those diverse interests and bring them forward, and that's what I think we've done at the Academy of Music, and we did that at the Academy of Fine Arts, and we ran a $15 million program there. So those are the things we've been involved in, and the other areas are areas that Anne's been involved in. And she was been on the Franklin Institute board for many years and was chairman for some period of time. and she'd been rather deeply involved in that institution, and a number of others as well. So we've been very active in the community, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Hal, you haven't actually talked at all about Anne, even how you met. Trying to keep going.
Well, it's 12 o'clock, so maybe break it's here and a good time to quit.
Postscript session.
Yeah, have one. She met, as you know, in the Senate, and we approached him. I had no relationship other than the fact that I had one time got some 30 executives together to meet him here in Philadelphia because he wanted to expose himself to people and to show them that a Democrat, not all Democrats were the same, that there were thinking Democrats who cared about people and so forth, but were conservative physically and whatnot. Anyway, we went to the Bill and had sent him the Yale Management Study and told him we'd like him to introduce legislation that mirrored the Yale Management Study. And he said, well, if the people from Yale and our people could convince his staff that this was the right direction, he would be happy to do it. And so he later introduced the legislation. Some people called it the ARCO Bill. But the Superfund legislation was modeled somewhat after the Bradley Bill with modifications and was introduced and turned out to be a very fine bill for the Senate, for the industry. If you look today, here it is many years later, I just sent out a letter to the chemical industry executives to support Bill's campaign for the presidency and reminded them that he was open to hearing what we had to say many years ago when he was a senator, saved the industry hundreds of millions of dollars, and that it would be nice to have a thinking, intelligent man with high integrity in the White House. So I can show you that letter. Just went out yesterday. We're having a dinner for him on June 30th. So that was another area that I felt I contributed something. And then the final area was the Chemical Industry Institute of Technology.
Toxicology,
CIIT. That was floundering badly. People were not living up to the support they had promised and so forth. And I worked with Dick Fleming, who had formerly been with Air Products and had gone down there to try and save that. And we went out and drummed up support, got many additional companies to join in and help with the support. And I thought, again, that was a valuable adjunct to the work that needed to be done in the chemical industry. And, of course, today there's even more work that has to be done. Studies that relate to human health and chemicals, and they have to be done by people who are unquestioned scientific integrity, and so we did help build support for CIIT, and I think it served its purpose quite well and does and is recognized as a quality source of data and information and research. So that was the role. I was active all the time in the organization, was supportive of it, and continued to be right up to the end. And I would join again if I had a U.S. company that was operating, because I think it's important to be able to understand the direction, the ideas, the problems that the industry faces. Furthermore, you establish relationships in that organization because there is only 40 to 60 people involved that are very important at the board meetings. And there are two board meetings a year with WISE, and which was very good because she got to socialize with these people and really, really get to know them in a non-competitive business environment. And so I look very fondly on the years we had. We made a great many friends there, and many of them are still friends today, and will continue to be friends for years to come. As I say, I would go back and join the CMA, even though it's gotten more expensive today. It's hard for a little company to be able to afford it. But they need to hear that too, and they need to know how to work with smaller companies, because the industry has every large company in this industry does an outstanding job in the environmental area and in the with safety and its employees and so forth. I mean, we have really good operators, but there are literally thousands of smaller companies, and that's one of the great challenges that CMA has. Is
how do they reach outside that pale?
Yeah. There are other organizations like the Society of Organic Chemical Manufacturers, SOCMA, and others, and we had many discussions about how you approach those people, and that's continuing today. But it is an important area for the future. The smaller companies can't afford the dues to the CMA, and they can't afford to handle the paperwork that comes out of the CMA. You just don't have the staff to go through all that stuff. So I still believe there's a challenge there in how they both include without overwhelming smaller companies in the industry.
You say you referred to the social aspect and the utility of that. Are there any other organizations that play that role as well? Where else would you go with AM?
Well, the SCI in Europe is very much that way. There's a meeting once a year, 2 or 3 days. It's very, very good for the same reason. You begin to develop relationships on a basis where it's both husbands and wives are involved. And so that's a very positive one. That whole subject is an interesting subject because we had a farewell party just the other night for Morris Geld, who's going down to run whatever's left of the Arco Chemical Company in Houston. And his wife talked about that the first time she met me was at a dinner that we had in Barcelona, where Anne was with me and so forth. Ralph Landau, who's a friend, an interesting man, ran a small, highly effective, very competitive people, a company with very competitive, aggressive people, with a demanding set of standards and so forth. But the one thing Ralph told me, he said, is, he said, it doesn't cost you very much to once or twice a year say to these people you're asking to work 70 hours or more a week, there's an interesting meeting, or I'm going to a meeting in Paris, why don't you and go with me? When you add up the cost, he said, maybe it costs you $25,000 or $50,000 a year extra. He said, but you get a tremendous amount of benefit out of that. He says, because the women feel involved, and they understand the demands on their husband, and you have a happy employee. And so when we always did that at Oxirane, where Ralph was a 50% partner, and I did that at Arco Chemical as well. So we tried to include the spouses. I can tell you in those days that there were no male spouses. There were women spouses. So I travel frequently with my senior executives and their spouses, their wives. And we entertain with our wives as we went around the world with the various people, and I'm trying to create an environment where the people knew you socially as well as professionally. And And I think that's an important element of creating a conducive environment to hard work and discussion. And I think the CMA functions better as a result of that. But there aren't too many organizations to do it. I've never been a member of the Chemical Manufacturers Association, so I don't know. If they have meetings where they invite them.
Which group?
Not chemical manufacturers, but the National Association of Manufacturers, or the Business Roundtable. I presume they do, but I don't know that.
Now, you just mentioned the SCI, and of course that you were active in that group, and that's really a very kind of anomalous group in some way, isn't it?
Well, nobody's ever tried to do anything with it. There's one of my great stories there. Ralph Landau was chairman. And I think there are only two people who've ever tried to do anything with it, Ralph Landau and myself. And Ralph decided that he would have not only a dinner to present the awards, but he would have 2 days of important papers. And Ralph knew everybody who was in the business. And he was very close to the Germans, Grunewald and Seyfelder were Bayer and BASF. And so he invited them to deliver a paper each, and then he invited Eric Shapiro the head of ICI, I'll think of his name in a minute, there's a man, he had trouble with his eyesight, I remember, but this goes back many years. And they had these papers in the seminar, and the meeting was held on Yom Kippur, the tail end of September. And on the first day, they were all on a panel as well as delivering these papers. Shapiro didn't show up. So the next day, Shapiro showed up, delivered his address. He said, ladies and gentlemen, and my peers on the panel, he said, I must apologize for not being here yesterday. I have read your remarks, so I am prepared to enter into the discussion. He said, but I had a choice to make. He said, being here with you or being with my God. Yesterday was the most holiest day in the year for us Jews, Yom Kippur. And he said, I can tell you how I respect you all, but you pale into insignificance when I compare you to my God. So I apologize, and he went on, which I thought was quite wonderful, because first of all, there weren't too many Jews in the chemical industry at that kind of level, and secondly, I think Ralph demonstrated his insensitivity to that. But that was one of the great moments. And actually, I tell that story because it was a good idea in terms of linking the dinner and a seminar. When I did it years
later, but it didn't. But nobody was.
Nobody else continued because it's work. It's work. I did it differently. What I did was have a dialogue amongst CEOs on a suggested subject, and I asked Ed Woolard if he would make a statement to begin the discussion. I did that twice, actually. And depending upon who you get to make the opening statement, you either get a very good dialogue or not. So there is an opportunity when you bring together the top people of the industry to do something constructive with them, but the people who are bringing them together have to be willing to do the work that's necessary to plan and suggest the subjects and make it provocative enough that you get disagreement around the table or different points of view. And I like that approach. This doesn't involve a lot of other people and so forth, but at least to have an approach in ARCA we called Operation Dialogue. And we always engaged our protagonists in dialogue, whether it was the Friends of the Earth or other people of the National Wildlife. We always were willing to sit down at the table and select a subject and express our points of view. And so I like that process. And, you know, as a matter of fact, it's maybe something that at some point you can have that kind of a series at Chemical Heritage, because there is always something gained from it. Most people don't really explain or understand the other guy's position very well, and if they're willing to sit and listen carefully, they usually come out learning something. And it was reminds me of a session we had where I represented the Chemical Manufacturers Association at the meeting, and I suggested that we bring together into a seminar at the Chemical Manufacturers fall meeting in New York City all the people who were active in banning lead, all the environmental issues. And each one got up and talked about their particular reason for why this should be done and that should be done. And I got up and I said, well, now I said, I understand much better what it is you want to do, and I'm going to give you a set of statistics and tell you how much money we have, and we'd like you to tell me how much we spend on each of the asbestos removal, veining lead, eliminating this, that, something. And I said, let me start by telling you that there are probably 100 people a year who suffer brain damage because they've eaten the lead paint off the windowsills in their houses. And let me tell you, there's one person a year who breathes asbestos in a school and winds up with cancer. And then let me tell you, there are a million women a year who have breast cancer, and, you know, some percentage, 25% of them die. And we went on and on. I said, now, I'd like each of you to take a few minutes and tell me, we have $1 billion to spend. How do you like to divide it up, and why? Well, most of them said, we've got to do more. I said, no. I said, I made the rules. And the rule is that we have only $1 billion, and we have to divide it, you see. Now, how would you propose we do that? Well, that thought never occurred to me. And I said, do you realize we've spent $300 billion on asbestos removal, and we've saved one life, or whatever the number is? But there aren't many. Whereas thousands of women are dying from breast cancer every day. Now, why do you come here and propose this foolishness when these poor women are dying by the thousands and you're taking their money? I mean, you know, it was incredible. I said, where did we get this nut? But the point is that, again, it's the process of dialogue and the point of view and putting all the competing people in one place, because some of these things are truly ridiculous. And intelligent people with an open mind usually come to the same conclusion. They may not say it or agree, but they understand it. So I'm saying this business of dialogue and proposing something as an alternative instead of just opposition, and all of that was are important concepts, and can only lead to good.
Let me ask you how, in going from chemical life a minute to other other corporations. You have served on various corporate boards.
Yes.
How did you get into that, and what do you learn? What you're trying to bring to the party? How does that whole thing work?
Yeah, over the years, I've served on a number of different ones. I've been on Provident Mutual Life Insurance Company for 20 years. I was on Core States Financial Corporation for 15 years. I was one of the founders of O'Brien Energy Systems. I was in on the founding of that, which was an entrepreneurial small company that was put together to exploit the move to cogeneration. I'm on Crown Cork and Seals board now, which is very interesting. I went on each of them for a different reason. First, Core States Financial, back when I went on that in 1979-1980, Maury Dorrance was the head of that, and I knew Maury Dorrance through my activities in the community. And he asked me if I would consider joining their board, which I did, which I enjoyed for many, many years as the company went through changes. And eventually ceased to exist because it was acquired by First Union. The same thing was true with the Provident Mutual Life Insurance Company. Jack Miller took over as CEO and was trying to revitalize their board and asked me if I would join the board again, which I did. O'Brien was different. Frank O'Brien wanted somebody who could help him, and I went on that board and brought with me Chuck Andes and Alan Reed, and I learned a lot there. Most of the other people were self-made people, entrepreneurs, and I watched Frank take that company and build it and then lose it and bankruptcy and lose everything and change his life rather dramatically. And what I learned from that, what is interesting, is you never bet the house on a business venture unless you're willing to risk losing it. And that, from his standpoint, you have to know when to quit. There's just a time when a business is going bad, when it's time to quit. And he had the ability to get out and get out whole, but it would have indicated that he lost everything. One of the things that you do learn in the oil industry that not too many people learn is that in the oil business, you drill down and you spend $100 million, but you can continue to drill, continue to try, and risk more money, but when you conclude you've got a dry hole, you just walk, turn it back and walk away from it. And when you get into a business, especially one that you've built, that's very difficult to do. O'Brien was a company that was going into bankruptcy. He wouldn't listen to anyone. He wanted to stick it out. He had built the company, controlled the shares. A very brilliant guy, entrepreneurial guy, and eventually he lost everything. The fact that the company was pretty well positioned and strong was when it came out of bankruptcy, everybody got paid off. So nobody lost anything. And I think that's a positive, but he lost everything personally. So I learned a lot watching that. And each of these has been special and challenging. The insurance industry has gone through turmoil, and the companies have changed, and new products, consolidation. The banking industry, the same thing, went through enormous mergers and acquisitions, consolidation. Crown Cork is now in an industry in a fair amount of turmoil. So the answer to your question is, seeing a different industry and a different perspective always helps you in understanding business in general and the different responses problems. And that's the reason why you go on a board. It's not for the money, but it's for the exposure to a different industry, different people, different problems, and how those problems are handled and solved. And hopefully you can contribute something to it. And in terms of it, a good CEO always wants to surround himself with strong people of quality who can help him as he tries to think through and address problems. And I can tell you, being at the top of a corporation is a lonely spot, because ultimately the decisions, particularly the difficult ones, fall to you. And so having a group of people on your board who you respect and who you can talk to that are not directly associated with the company is extremely worthwhile to a CEO. And having a good board is something everyone should do. Not all of the people recognize that. Not all the people really don't want the board involved and don't consult the board and think it's an appendage and something that's superfluous. I've been on at least one board like that, where the new CEO came in and really felt the board was more of an annoyance than it was a help.
Just have you any comment in relation here? This is kind of looking at Philadelphia region. You mentioned core states, and it's very striking how the banking industry began in this town and is here no more, and this sort of disappearance of the headquarters aspect of Philadelphia. I mean,
Well, it's I think in almost any business, you either grow or you die. And Core States was doing it pretty good job at growing and so forth, but it needed a final step that put it into the big leagues where it could remain independent. And it somehow, for various reasons, couldn't get there and was subsequently acquired. So it's very much a part of how effective your management is and how effective your board is. And we're faced with the same problem at Provident Mutual now. The insurance industry is consolidating and so forth. We're a relatively small player. The future requires capital, a large amount of capital, just to develop the systems and so forth that are necessary to run the company. And so just the other day at a board meeting, I said, look, we need to have a strategic planning committee of the board that decides where this company is going. And the management has made certain proposals, but the board needs to spend time thinking about that. Not too many companies get their boards involved in the strategic planning or direction of the company. And I might say, and it's interesting, when Crown merged with CGIP, which is a French company, they had a huge block of Crown stock, and they didn't ask to be in the management at all, but they asked for the formation of a strategic planning committee, of which the chairman of the CGIP group wanted to be chairman of the strategic planning committee of the board. And that board, that had six people on it. It was the chairman of the CGIP, the Baron Sillier, his cousin, and Felix Rowenton. On the other side was Bill Avery, myself, and Alan Rutherford. And I'm saying, I found that extremely useful and worthwhile because of the dialogue that went on there about the future direction of the company. We use consultants and so forth. So I'm saying an active board and an involved board helps, but unfortunately, in my experience, most don't let the boards get involved in those kinds of issues, and they should be. You have to ask yourself, what does the board do except to try and help the CEO with the overall direction of the company? And in many cases, it's survival. I'll give you an example, two examples. Both relate to core states. Maura Dorrance is a member of the Dorrance family, and they control Campbell Soup, and he had been involved in core states from the time. I think he was a young man and had been chairman for many years. And one day he came in and said to the board that he had fired the president, who was a man by the name of Dick Ravenscroft, and had fired the president, and wanted to appoint a new CEO. He was going to retire, and he went on to tell us he was going to appoint a man named Terry Larson as CEO. And I listened carefully to his explanation for why he fired Ravenscroft, and so forth. Then I raised my hand, and I said, pardon me, I said, Maureen, I said, but I'm really quite confused. He said, about what? I said, about why you think you have the authority to recommend the CEO to this board. I said, that's our job, not your job. And, I couldn't possibly vote for this man